smooth-sided toads. Until I started flying nonstop on ExpressJet Airlines, it was hard to find the time for my toad breeding. Proper toad pairing, timing toad cycles, setting the right toad mood is a consuming process, not to mention dealing with the intricacies of the toad mating ritual. Settle down there, Charlie. But with the time I save flying ExpressJet Airlines, it's like I'm living in a Peruvian toad utopia. Except mine's in Fresno.
Welcome to an airline that measures travel satisfaction and the time it saves you. Because we know there are things you'd rather be doing than flying.
Come on, Erwin. Hop to it.
Non-stop flights on ExpressJet Airlines. What are you waiting for?
Fly ExpressJet Airlines non-stop from Fresno to LA, Ontario, Long Beach, and San Diego while enjoying free XM radio. Go to ExpressJet.com to book your flight today.
Live, local, and committed to the Central Valley. News Talk 580 KMJ every day.
Morgan Chase company officials blamed market rumors for the run. IndyMac opens under new management tomorrow. Federal officials are running it. They say they weren't confident the bank could meet its depositors' demands. John Bovenzi runs the new bank. He has this advice for all depositors.
You have less than $100,000, you don't need to worry. Because for 95 to 98% of the customers in a bank, they have less than $100,000 in account.
Some regulators blame New York Democratic Senator Charles Schumer for causing a run at IndyMac when he said it was at risk. He says it was. And the regulators were asleep at the switch. One NATO official says it's the fighting season in Afghanistan, and that was deadly in evidence today. 9 American soldiers were killed, 15 wounded when militants attacked a U.S. outpost near the Pakistan border. NATO spokesman Mark Leahy says the Americans were hit with machine gun fire, rocket-propelled grenades, mortars.
We do believe that the insurgents who attacked that outpost suffered very heavy casualties during several hours of fighting. Obviously, you can see from the tragic casualty toll, it was a very intense fight.
Analysts say this is evidence the Taliban is once again a major fighting force in Afghanistan. When should the U.S. leave Iraq? Hot question in Washington.
I'm Tom Foti. What do senior senators make of reports that Iraqi leaders are now talking about U.S. troop pullback timetables? Indiana Republican Richard Lugar of the Foreign Relations Committee.
It's apparent that a majority of Iraqi people would like to assert sovereignty, and that means American withdrawal.
Michigan Democrat Carl Levin is chairman of Senate Armed Services.
Instead of resisting Iraqi apparent effort to have a timetable, we should welcome that. It's long overdue. We should insist that there be a timetable.
Senators Levin and Lugar were on CBS's Face the Nation. Tom Foti, CBS News, Washington.
Officials say Israel has agreed to release more Palestinian prisoners. That move is seen as an overture to the Palestinians as the two sides push ahead with peace talks. This is CBS News.
Say you're driving along without a TomTom GPS and you realize you're low on gas. You could just find the nearest station, even though the price seems a little bit high, and as the numbers on the screen march onward and upward like some never-ending journey toward bankruptcy, you start to wonder why your gas tank never seems so bottomless, or if there's just some gremlin in there guzzling away all your hard-earned dollars. Or you could use a TomTom. With daily fuel price updates, TomTom finds you the lowest price on gas and directs you right to it. TomTom, go confidently.
A message from the Orbitz Traveler Wellness Center.
Hello, Dr. Martin Pakulski-Blatz here. I just want to tell you about the Orbitz Great American Sale, where you can save 30% on hotels in great American cities. So get going, because really, is there anything more American than America? No, there isn't. So head over to Orbitz.com today and save.
Valid for travel 7708 through 1124, 08 for pay 3108, see site for details.
I always wanted to be a fireman when I grew up.
A pilot.
A teacher.
For me, it was an engineer.
Over the years, my dream didn't change.
But the rising cost of college was a big reality check.
I was determined to make it on my own, to find a way that I could pay for college.
That's why I joined the National Guard.
The Guard gives me money for college.
So I can go to school full-time and fly part-time.
My unit helps out after a natural disaster hits.
Like after a tornado.
Flood.
Blizzard.
So I get to help people, just like I always wanted.
And around here, that's almost every June.
Monday through Friday, my job might be in finance, but when a wildfire breaks,
breaks out, I get called up to help control it. There's no bigger rush than being a firefighter in the Guard.
Then flying a Black Hawk.
Then leading my squad.
Then rebuilding my hometown.
The National Guard put me in charge of my future.
Thanks to the Guard, I'm becoming who I always wanted to be.
You can reach your education and career goals faster in the National Guard. Visit 1-800-GO-GUARD.com or call 1-800-GO-GUARD and ask us how much you'll receive towards your college expenses.
Sponsored by the California National Guard, carried by the California Broadcasters Association and this station.
I died last week, shot 3 times in the back. I guess you could argue I had it coming, but my mama, nah, she didn't deserve none of this. I watched her that day, at my grave. I never meant to cause that kind of pain. Yeah, I was in a gang, bad gang. Thought I was untouchable. I was just playing the fool. But my mama and my little brother, they're the ones that gotta pay the price. They're the ones that gotta deal with it all. You think my gang kids? I'm gone now. Hell nah. They just gonna pull in the next stupid fool and wipe up the streets with his sorry self. Goodbye, mama. I wish I could tell you I'm sorry.
If you see gang activity or know of gang members, call the police. Together, we can save our kids. Call toll-free 1-888-498-STOP, 1-888-498-STOP, or valleycrimestoppers.org.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com. We're with you every Sunday afternoon from 4 until 5. Remember, if you miss a program, you want to go back and listen to it later, you can hear it by clicking on KMJ Podcast at KMJ580.com. If there's a veteran in your life that you'd like to tell me about, see if I can catch up to him or her on this program, you can email me, Paul at KMJ580.com. Now, I'm very thrilled to have as our guest today a real hometown hero from Visalia and a young man who beat a lot of odds to be with us today and telling his story. You'll hear all about it, his incredible story of survival by the time this program is over. But let's start early on, Mr. Bob McNutt of Visalia. Now, you were part of a pretty big family growing up, right?
Right. I was the 14th of 15 children.
The 14th of 15 children. In fact,
right.
You even had a brother that served in World War One, correct?
Right. He was cast in World War One, and he lived a pretty good life. He died at 78 years old, but he carried an oxygen tank around with him for years. But he doing that. But my dad was also, of course, my dad was in the Spanish-American War, and he's a veteran from that. And there was three of my other brothers that were myself was in the, besides myself was in the Second World War. They were all in the Army, and I was the only one in the Navy.
So you were a bit of a renegade there, huh?
Yeah. Well, I was the first one in, though. See, they come in after. They were drafted, some of them were. One of them enlisted, I think, yeah.
What made you decide to enlist in the Navy?
Well, it was during the Depression, really, and there wasn't any jobs for young people, you know. I mean, even a lot of the older people were out of work and everything like that, so the Navy looked pretty good for a young person, you know, at that time, you know. That was way back in 1939, see. So that was, the Navy looked pretty good to me instead of the Army. I went to high school with ROTC and put Navy time in, or Army time in, you might say, in high school. But other than that, I preferred the Navy.
Now, this was long before you ended up in Visalia. Tell our listeners where you were at the time.
I was in, when I enlisted in the service, I was in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I worked for Kalamazoo Stove, off and on, part-time work, you know, mostly in the mailing room, mailing advertisements and stuff like that. But I was living with my sister up there in Kalamazoo, and one of the first, they opened a recruiting station in the Navy up there. I was one of the first ones in.
Well, and for a kid from Kalamazoo, I imagine getting out on a ship in the Pacific Ocean sounds pretty enticing.
Well, yes, it took a while. I mean, you know, of course, when you enlisted like that, then we went in, actually were sworn in the Navy in Detroit, Michigan, actually. And we went to, where they swore in about 40 of us, I think, at the same time. And then we were shipped to Great Lakes, Illinois, and put our boot camp in there and did quite a bit of patrolling at night along the Navy Pier and places like that, which is a big, Navy Pier is a big deal now back there in Chicago, but in those days it was handled just by the Navy. But then from there we went to, after I got out of boot camp, we went to Seattle, Washington, and got on the cruiser Houston. And from Seattle we went to San Francisco and put 2 weeks in this harbor down there, and that was during the time of the World Fair in San Francisco, so we had some pretty good liberties over there at the fair.
Oh, I imagine so.
Yeah, that was the old Treasure Island that the Navy took over afterwards. See, during the war, they took over Treasure Island.
But you didn't stay on the Houston, did you?
No, they just took it to Pearl Harbor. It had a few recruits on there. I don't know exactly how many. There was quite a few of us. And we were transferred to different ships over there in Pearl Harbor. And I was transferred to the Monahan. And that was in October of 1939. So.
And we'll get to the future of the Monahan before this show is over. But I bet at some point you look back and say that you're glad that you didn't stay on the USS Houston.
Right, yes, because it was I think it was in the Java Sea over there.
Yep, in fact, the Sunda Strait near the Java coast there, February 28th, 1942,
Yes.
And I imagine you heard about that at the time.
Yes, and I knew a few of the guys that were kept on there, you know, that I don't know really what happened to them. Some of them became prisoners of war for quite a while and got out later, but I don't know. I didn't see any of them later after the war even, so I really don't know what happened to all of them.
But there's some experiences that you had that probably give you a decent sense for what they went through, and we're going to get to that before this program is over. Let's talk about what it was like at Pearl Harbor before the Japanese attack, because you were there after the Houston took you there. You were assigned to the Monahan, but you remained in Pearl Harbor for close to 2 years, right?
Right. We go out on patrol duty out in front, you know. All the destroyers took turns doing that, and then we maneuvered quite a bit with the fleet in different times, and then we go out with the carriers, you know, and for different maneuvers, checking on different ways of, you know, and we did a lot. They do the carrier planes sometimes would drag targets behind them for our anti-aircraft of shooting, you know, so that we could practice with that. And a lot of that. But in the meantime, one of the nights that we were patrolling out in front of the harbor, we had a garbage barge that was coming out of the harbor, and the guy at the helm didn't see it in time, and he had to turn, and he turned over on the coral.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and we went aground, and it... it's the screws on the back were just mangled up in the shafts and everything all had to be changed. So we put quite a bit of time in dry dock and doing that. In the meantime, we had accumulated one of the best softball teams that we had. So it was plenty of plenty of leisure time besides work time, too. There's a lot of work that had to be done. And
if you're going to have leisure time, Pearl Harbor's the place to have a little leisure time.
Well, it's the weather's pretty good, you know. It usually rained every afternoon about 4 o'clock or, you know, or something like that. But it would rain to dry off right away, almost, you might say, you know. But usually every day you get a little few sprinkles.
And the Monahan was a Farragut-class destroyer. What were your duties on the Monahan?
Well, I was with the... When I first got on it, I was just a seaman. You know, cleaning the decks and stuff like that all the time. But then I went into the fire department with the fire rooms and was a fireman for quite a few years, and ended up being a water tender, what they call a water tender, you know, to take samples of water and change salt water into drinking water, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and then they have this special boiler water, too, that you make for... without as less salt as possible, you know, and you can get in it. And all that, you did a lot of testing and stuff, a lot of water testing and stuff while you're making it in evaporators. So,
well, as busy as they kept you before all the action started, once it started, you were pretty much in the thick of it. We're going to take our first commercial break here, but when we come back, we're going to hear more from Visalius Bob McNutt, and he's going to tell us what it was like on the morning of December 7th, 1941. The Monahan was about to set out to chase an unidentified submarine when the air attack began at Pearl Harbor, so we're going to get that experience through Bob's eyes as he remembers it, and that's just the beginning of all the experiences that he survived during World War II. So we'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes. Our guest this week, Visalius Bob McNutt, on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On 580 KMJ, this is a WAC Commissioner's Cup report on Fresno State Athletics.
Stu Bemme has been given the reins to guide the new women's lacrosse program at Fresno State. For the past 9 seasons, Bemme has been the head coach at Division III Nazareth College in Rochester, New York. During her time in Rochester, Bemme guided the Golden Flyers to 6 NCAA tournament appearances and a record of 115-39. Bemme is a 5-time Conference Coach of the Year recipient and consistently had her Nazareth teams ranked among the nation's elite. Prior to her stay at Nazareth, Bemme served as the women's soccer and lacrosse coach at SUNY Geneseo. In college, Bemme was an All-American in both soccer and lacrosse at SUNY Cortland. At Fresno State, Bemme's Bulldogs will compete in the Mountain Pacific Sports Federation against the likes of Stanford, Cal, and Oregon.
For complete coverage of Fresno State sports, it's News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com.
Seek Broadcasting, an equal opportunity employer, is dedicated to providing broad outreach for all job vacancies at its 5 radio stations, KMJ, Kiss Country, Mega 97.9, Y101, and the new Jack 105.9. We seek the help of local community organizations in referring qualified applicants. Community organizations that wish to receive our vacancy information should contact Jan Sansom at 559-490-5814 or Stephanie Whitaker at 559-490-5978. Additionally, all listeners are encouraged to routinely check our online list of job vacancies by going to kmj580.com, kskS.com, mega979.com, y101hits.com, and 1059jack.com.
Help bust the meth lab and Crime Stoppers will crank up the cash. If you know about an active lab or run across lab equipment, call Crime Stoppers. We'll pay you up to $1,000 and you remain completely anonymous, big or small. We're cracking down on meth labs. If you can help bust the lab, call 498-STOP and Crime Stoppers will crank up the cash.
The Shields family is a real California family, providing real hope for others.
In 2005, our dreams of owning a home had become a reality, but recently turned into a nightmare. Our loan had an adjustable rate.
We take action to keep our home.
If the interest rate on your home has gone up and you can't afford the payments, act now. You might qualify for help.
If it worked for our family, it might work for yours.
Call 888- 1-800-995-HOPE or visit yourhome.ca.gov to learn more. This message is brought to you by the State of California, aired by the California Broadcasters.
Hi. Hey, you know the three little pigs? I'm the guys who built with straw, sticks, and bricks. Well, I'm the fourth little pig, and I build with steel. Yep, I use Miracle Truss. Hey, that brick place kept the wolf out, but a little earthquake took that sucker right down. Miracle Truss is lighter and stronger than other steel buildings. Talk about hopping and puffing. Miracle Truss buildings can take hurricane-force winds. From a small workshop to a large commercial structure, any length, it's the best, which is why it's got the best warranty. Hey, don't wait for the price of steel to climb another 30%. Order now and you can defer delivery. Just go to MiracleTrust.com or call 1-877-51-TRUST. That's 1-877-51-TRUSS. Call now and you'll get the manufacturer's price. I did. And they called the pig who built the brick house smart. Yeah, oink. Call 1-877-51-TRUST now.
I'm Gary Selzy, three-time NHRA world champion. I drive hot rods at speeds well over 300 miles an hour. Driving to me is not a game. Neither is hunger. It affects literally thousands of people each year right here in Fresno County. That's why I've joined the team of the Fresno Rescue Mission to help drive away hunger. When you donate your car, truck, boat, or RV, you can help those trying to survive on the streets and back alleys of Fresno. And you'll receive a tax deduction. In many cases, the donated value of your vehicle will be worth more to you than what you might have sold it for or traded it in for. The mission will fix it, clean it up, and sell it. And the proceeds will be used to provide even more hot, nutritious meals for poor families throughout Fresno County this year. You'll know you've helped drive away hunger. Thank you and God bless.
Call Rescue Mission Super Thrift Store with cars at 440-0870. That's 440-0870.
Want to know a dirty little secret? Many crop protection dealers sell their growers' private information to manufacturers, and some allow their software provider to sell sensitive, identifiable information to others. Hi, this is Karen Musson for Gartutelian Incorporated. We know this is hard to believe, but it's true, and we think it's a shameful practice. We use software that guarantees not to sell personal data from our PCA's recommendations, and we don't share our growers' information. If privacy is important to you, protect yourself. Ask your crop protection dealer not to sell or supply your identifiable data to Bayer Crop Science or any other manufacturer or software company without your written permission. We value our customers' privacy. We're a small business, big on service. We're Gartutelian Incorporated. Call us at 1-800-696-6108 or check our website specials at gtipros.com. That's 1-800-696-6108.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ, where each week we catch up with Valley veterans of World War II. As we continue with Visalia's Bob McNutt, I want to commend the newspaper down in Visalia, the Visalia Times-Delta, which has done a terrific job of honoring World War II veterans from Tulare County and archiving their stories online. If you want to see more about that, go to the Visalia Times-Delta's website at visaliatimesdelta.com, and there you'll probably see a picture of Bob McNutt and read a few of his experiences during the war. When we left off with Bob before the break, we had gotten to December 7th, 1941. He was on a destroyer, the USS Monahan. What do you remember about that Sunday morning, Bob? What's the first thing that you remember happening?
Well, we were getting ready to go to mass at one of the battle wagons waiting on board, and we were in our dress whites, you know, all nice and pretty and everything, and when the Japanese started raiding, so what happened, the water tender next to me told me to get up on their stack and take the cover off, because we cover the stack to keep the birds out,
right,
you know, from inside. And so I was up there taking the lacings off. I cut them with a knife because I didn't have time to lace them one by one around the halyards that was up there. So I was peeling that back, and the planes were coming in and bombing using torpedo planes on the battle wagons. And then we got underway right away because our boilers were warm from the night before. We just come in from patrol duty the night before, so we got underway fairly fast. And on the way out, one of the ships crossed the Tangiers, and the Curtis. They were aircraft maintenance ships.
Right.
Radioed us over that there was a small sub in the harbor just getting ready to torpedo one of them. So what the captain did, he backed down and ran over the top of the sub and dropped a couple of 600-pound ash cans, what they called depth charges,
right,
on top of this submarine, and it blew the first half of it off. So. But they just didn't know it was a two-man sub to begin with when they found one guy in there. The other guy was blown to bits, I guess. And then we continued on out of the harbor after we sank that sub, and firing any aircraft all the time and at the planes coming over. They tried to strafe us and stuff like that, but we didn't get hit much. And didn't get anybody. Nobody got hit as far as that goes on that day.
You know, I've talked to a lot of Pearl Harbor survivors, and most of them are friends of yours in the local chapter of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association. But so many of them tell me that it took a few moments for them to figure out that this was real, that everyone thought it was exercises, maneuvers, because like you had mentioned to us earlier, you guys had been practicing for the event of wartime operations, even though they hadn't come yet.
Right.
Did you know immediately that this was real, that those were Japanese planes and not American planes, and that the war was on?
I didn't notice it at first, but somebody yelled it. Well, those planes don't look like ours. I said they got the big orange... looked like a big orange sun on the side, you know, and so everybody knew that. Well, we were told about them before time, you know. I mean, what they looked like and everything, and most of them, most of those planes were made by Mitsubishi, the same one that manufactures the cars, you know.
Right.
And it was so we saw quite a few of those coming over, you know, at that time, but then we knew something was wrong, you know. So we never did get to church that morning. We were on our way out.
And that seems to me like that would be pretty intense for you, especially when you're climbing up the stack of a destroyer, cutting off the cover on it so you guys can get out of the harbor. I imagine it wasn't quiet around you, and from that perch up there, you could probably see a lot if you had time to look.
I didn't really have time to look. I had to look to see what I was doing so I didn't fall off of the place, you know. And, you know, there wasn't that much of a walk around on the, you know, to hang on to as far as that goes. So you had to watch what you were doing, you know. And I got that off of there as fast as I could and got down off of there because it wasn't any place to be. It wasn't the right place to be.
And you mentioned the Monahan sinking the two-man submarine.
Right.
That was later pulled up. I know you've seen pictures of what that looked like.
And, yeah.
When was it, though, that you and the rest of your crew, for that matter, realized the magnitude of what had happened on December 7th? I know that you guys were out patrolling outside of the harbor for probably about a week or so, but did you know immediately that this was a greatly significant event and that the devastation was pretty severe?
Yeah, we knew that. We got a lot of reports and from what was going on inside, you know, and they kept us informed, you know, because they knew it was real serious, you know, something that had to happen. So we had to be on the alert on the outside of the harbor because there was other those small submarines, you know. They run one of them up onto the beach, and it was the first Japanese that we captured during the war, you know.
Right.
And so that's why they knew there was a two-man sub, because it was two men in that submarine that they run up. And so I don't know, you know, the war sank a sub out before, and they warned the people inside, but they just, I don't know, people, I guess they warned the wrong people, or, you know, because somebody, they just didn't pay attention to what was really happening, because they knew that the people on the radar picked up the planes. We, of course, we hear all this afterwards, you know.
Sure.
And picked up the planes coming in on the new radar, which, and then they thought it was there was a fleet of bombers coming over from the United States, and they figured that's what it was too. So I don't know, but a lot of things were miscalculated and things like that.
Well,
you don't really know what would have happened if they'd had been alerted anyway, see.
Very true.
And another thing is, if they would have attacked it probably, and the ships would have been out to sea, they might have sank more of them out there that would never have been recovered, too. So there's a lot of things that, because it happened in the harbor, you know, they were ordered to save some of those ships. And you don't know whether it would have happened if they'd have been out to sea, seeing it.
There's so many questions like that throughout the whole war, and I know for you personally, there are a lot of those situations, too, and I want to touch on a few of those before we're done. Before we get away from Pearl Harbor, though, as a Pearl Harbor survivor, when you see the Arizona Memorial now, or every year on December 7th, what are the emotions that come to mind for you? What are the things that you think about?
Well, you think of all the people that are still down there, you know. I mean, they're still underneath the memorial. And it's kind of hard, you know. There was a lot of wasted time and material and people, you know. And I don't know. You think about a lot of things, and you just feel how lucky you were that you got away yourself, you know.
Well, and you'd have a few more of those moments before your time in the Navy was done. And I imagine for you, too, since you had already been in for 2 years at that point,
right.
Now the war is on. Did you figure at the time, this is going to be going for a while, I'm not getting home anytime soon?
Well, we never thought of that. You know, we spent a lot of time, everybody was in the same ship, I mean, same deal. You didn't get home every year or something like that. You're supposed to have 30 days leave every year, you know, but you never did get as far as that goes. That was, I didn't get home until, I don't even remember the dates, but it was after I spent some time up in the Aleutians, you know, during the war.
Yeah, I want to get to that, too, and before you got up there, the Monahan was involved in Midway, wasn't it?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in Midway, and in the Coral Sea and the Marshall Islands and just a different group like that and Tarawa and Weetok and all those places, you know, just a few of the places we've been.
Well, yeah, and some of the biggest moments in the war. And you said that you knew right away how significant the attack on Pearl Harbor had been. At Midway, and I know that the Monahan for the first 2 days of that battle was screening the Big E, the Enterprise. We've
right.
Had some veterans from that carrier on this program. But did you realize after Midway how significant that was? And did the big picture of the morale of the American people and kind of that turning point in the battle against the Japanese, did that occur to you at the time? Or was it you were too close to the situation to see that?
We didn't realize how lucky we were, you know, to get that many carriers of the Japs. We didn't find that out till it was probably about a week later. I mean, people on board our ship, you know, communication didn't get around like they do nowadays. You know, I mean, you don't have that fast of information, you know. But when they started totaling what really happened and everything afterwards, well, then it made a lot of difference. I mean, because you didn't get the all the pressure that you had before, because they had so many ships. The Japanese had so many ships, you know, the carriers that we sank that day was the biggest part of their fleet, you know, I mean, and that it was a big victory for us. That was really the turning point of the war, I think.
Absolutely. I think the historians agree with you on that, and you were there to see it, and you would have to see a lot more before your time in the Navy was done. We're going to catch another break here. When we come back, Bob, I want to hear about the Battle of the Komondorsky Islands, as you referenced in the Aleutians, and then beyond that, the most dangerous situation that you faced and probably the longest odds that you beat in that typhoon that claimed so many American lives. Thankfully, not yours. We want to hear that story of survival, and that's what we will get next when Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580. KMJ.
Listen. Did you hear that? Okay, one more time. That's the sound your print ad makes. Doesn't exactly get your attention, does it? At Peak Broadcasting, we help your business make some noise. Just listen to what Ray Okonjo of NTV Media has to say about advertising with Peak.
When we start developing strategic plans for our local clients, we usually start with Peak Broadcasting, an organization that understands this market, that provides great value. And at the end of the day, the most important thing for local advertisers and clients of ours is it works. It absolutely works for our client.
Peak Broadcasting will help your business make some noise. We have the top 5 out of 6 adult radio stations in the market and almost 400,000 listeners tuning in every week. 400,000 people. That's what 400,000 people sound like. And they will all hear your message. Call Carlene Dark at 490-5830 and put the power of Peak to work for your business. Peak Broadcasting. 5 great stations. 1 quick call.
On the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com. My guest this week, a World War II veteran from Visalia, Bob McNutt. One of the most incredible stories of survival that I have heard in the time that I've been trying to catch up with World War II veterans around the valley and around the country. And had a chance to visit with Bob on the television side a while back. Maybe you've seen him in the Visalia Times Delta and some of the accounts of his experiences. If you did, maybe you remember what he faced in the Battle of the Komondorsky Islands. That's up in the Aleutians and the Bering Sea. And that was a situation, Bob, where the Monahan was part of a group of American ships that was greatly outnumbered. Was it about 2-1, Japanese to American?
Yes, it was that day. And our heavy cruiser, the Salt Lake, was dead in the water there for a while. It lost power and everything. I don't know how it did it anyway. But anyway, the destroyers, we concentrated on the lead Japanese and lead Japanese cruiser, and the 5-inch guns lowered, the shells lowered the superstructure on the bridge and everything, and they figured the reason the Japanese turned around, I don't know why, but they reasoned that they must have killed the admiral at that time on board the ship, and because the Japanese, what they do, they turn around and re-elect somebody, but like in our Navy, the next in command is the one next lower ranked officer, you know.
Right.
And we do it a little different.
So your ship, the destroyer Monahan, even though it was part of a group outnumbered 2-1, fired those guns and torpedoes so well that the Japanese turned around. Got out of there. And
got out of there.
I imagine there's probably a lot of praying going on when you saw how outnumbered you were. But what were you doing personally during that intense situation?
That intense situation, I was in charge of one of the fire rooms at that time. So we were just putting out smoke screens, you know, and laying a smoke screen for the ships to go in. What they did, they laid quite a bit of smoke up when the ships turned around to make the torpedo runs. Then the ships run out through it and through the smoke screen and shot the torpedoes. And then we turn around and come back. And you know, with all that shooting and stuff, you know, before the before the Japs turned around even in Eilat. We were down to about the last five shells, I think, that we had for five-inch guns. We were just getting out of ammunition. And it was shooting star shells and everything, you know, at that time.
Wow.
Because that's all we had left. So it was, everything worked out because I guess all the prayers worked because they turned around and left, and that was the only thing that saved us that day.
So another close call, and
another close call.
Made it on through.
Right.
And you would think after Pearl Harbor and Midway and the Komondorski Islands that maybe the Monahan had done enough, but no, Uncle Sam had more plans for you guys, and as you referenced it, you were protecting convoys through the invasion of Tarawa and a lot of those intense Pacific battles.
Right.
And I think, well, I'll ask you, as far as the most intense situation that you faced as a Navy man during World War II and when you felt like your life was in danger the most, what would you say that was?
Well, that was the day that the ship turned over in the typhoon out there in the Philippines, and it was, I don't know, it's kind of hard to explain or talk about. I mean, the ship rolled over back and forth, and every time it turned, you didn't know whether it was going to come back or not, you know, and it just happened at the time when it did turn over, I was on the right side. That was up.
Now, let's put this in perspective. Here you are. You're in the Navy for 2 years before Pearl Harbor. You survive Pearl Harbor. You go through Midway. You survive that. The Komondorski Islands we just covered. Some of the other battles in the Pacific that killed so many Americans.
Right.
You survived all this. And then in December of 1944, this tropical cyclone, Typhoon Cobra, as it's been called, some
right.
refer to it as the Typhoon of 44, or
right.
Halsey's Typhoon, because it was Bull Halsey's Navy at that point, or his part of the Navy.
Right.
This absolutely devastated the Third Fleet more than probably any battle did. I mean, this was a huge event, and it sounds like the crews of the ships didn't really know it was coming. Did you have any idea that something like this could happen?
We didn't have any idea this could happen. No, we've been through, you know, typhoons before, but this one was, you know, it was an extra powerful one, I guess. And one of the reasons that the ships, of course, it was four ships lost that day that turned over, and one of the reasons was we had to pump the ballast off. We were supposed to refuel, is what the whole deal was.
Right.
And had to pump the ballast off, and they just had half of the ballast, half of the ship was just like a cork. I mean, it was high on the water like that, and it rolled a lot easier because there's not that much of a draft on destroyers like on the bigger ships. But even some of the bigger ships took quite a beating out there that day. And
and this is a destroyer. I mean, this is a
yeah.
fairly decent-sized sailing vessel in itself. And this was in the Philippine Sea, right?
Right.
300 miles east of Luzon, December 17th, 1944. What, though, I'm sure this came on pretty quickly, but what do you remember as the first sign that something's not right here and this is going to be pretty scary? What kind of gave you that clue?
Well, the way the ship was rolling, it just seemed like it just couldn't keep that up, you know, all the time, because you roll over, and when the side that you were, what I was on, rolled over, you know, just filled up with water and stuff like that. You're just hanging on.
So you were below deck when this happened?
No, I was on top side, really, but I was under shelter. I mean, there was kind of an overhang, like the ladder to the bridge and stuff like that was right there, and there was a life raft right there by the entrance to where you'd go into the mess hall is where it was, see, and it was right there by the kitchen, actually, where the kitchen for the where the cooks were and everything in there.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to keep things in from spilling all over the place, you know.
So as you're being thrown all over the deck, you see this life raft.
Well, I saw the life raft, but I kept an eye on that all the time. I mean, because you never knew what was going to happen, you know. I mean, when the thing did turn over and stop and lay there and didn't go roll back, well, that's when you scramble. And it's not that easy to scramble on a something laying on its side that way either. I mean, you have to pull, you know, you overhand to yourself.
What was going through your mind at this time? Did you think, this is it for me? I don't think I can survive this?
Well, I didn't know whether I could or not. See, I mean, I was, like you said, I was praying a lot. I was going along and had to, trying to just get on board something, you know, get a hold of something. We didn't know whether we were, I got a hold of the raft is what I got a hold of, but a lot of people tried to get a hold of anything they could, you know, to help float. The Copac life jackets that we wore were they helped quite a bit, you know, as far as keeping you afloat and all that. But some of them had some of the May West deals, you know, and they didn't work as good.
Well, I imagine you probably couldn't hear anything but the wind, because 120 knots is some of the speed they reported. Is that all you hear, is just the howling of that wind?
Just howling and noise. You couldn't hear anybody talk or anything. You couldn't hear any, you know, there wasn't, if there was screaming or anything like that, you couldn't hear it, you know, unless it was somebody right next to you. And,
did it seem like it was going by in slow motion for you, or it was happening so fast you didn't know what was happening?
Well, I just didn't know what was happening, actually. I mean, you know, you're just hoping for the best is all you do. You're just groping for the best. I don't know how to say it otherwise. You know, it just, you just hope and pray. That's all you do.
That's all you can do.
Yeah.
Someone was listening. I know that, and I know it's not easy to talk about either. And I appreciate you doing that. And we'll take our final break right here. When we come back, we'll pick up the story from there. Bob found the life raft, but that wasn't anywhere near the end of this. It was still a long fight and some pretty steep odds for Bob McNutt to beat back in December of 1944. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580. KMJ.
Hi, this is Catherine Weakland, Community Relations Director of Poverello House. In the past, all we could do for the homeless mentally ill was to provide basic food, hygiene, and medical services. However, recently we received some on-site help. Now we have a portable trailer on our property where county and Kingsview counselors are available to help homeless mentally ill clients. It isn't a complete answer, but it's a step in the right direction. Visit our website at www.poverellohouse.org for more information, as well as news about the upcoming Granville Homes Home of Hope event.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Is a meaningful tune to anyone who has served in the U.S. Navy. Bob McNutt did that during World War II. He's been kind enough to join us this afternoon on Hometown Heroes. It's our final segment now, and as always, the time went by in a hurry, but there's still some pretty significant ground to cover here. Ground is something that would have been a welcome sight to Bob McNutt in December of 1944. We left off with him fleeing the sinking USS Monahan, a destroyer that was turned over by that terrible typhoon in late 1944 in the western Pacific Ocean. And Bob found a life raft, and then what? Just hold on for dear life?
Well, we held on for dear life. It was there's quite a few of us on it to begin with. The raft turned over twice during the storm.
I'm surprised it was only twice.
Yeah, well, but anyway, it... you know, those waves are pretty high. I mean, anywhere from 40 to 50 and 60 foot high. Some of them said they were 70, but I don't know. I just was riding them, that's all.
Were you trying not to look, or were you having to look to try to stay balanced and afloat?
Well, I was inside the float hole. You know, it has a wooden rack on the inside that, you know, you stand on.
Mm-hmm.
And you're up to your waist and up to your waist, a little above your waist in water, and there's a line all the way around the outside, that people could hang on to if they, you know, to get a hold of. But I always had my arms over the back and hanging on to the lines that way. I mean, just to hang on to the deal. It was about 13 of us on it to begin with. Or better than that, maybe. And I don't know how many people on the sides. But then the first time it turned over, of course, I was hanging on with the ropes, and so I got back onto it. Like I said, I hung on even when I was thrown out of with the group, and some of them couldn't get back on it, and some of them didn't know. I didn't know whether they wanted to get back on or not. See, you know, you never know about these people, and in these times, people have different ways of thinking. But mine was just to try and stay aboard the raft that way, but it turned over, and there was only about eight of us we got back on it that first time, and then the second time it happened, I don't know if it's probably maybe a whole day later. I don't know exactly what time it was.
Yeah, I imagine it's pretty easy to lose track of time when you're on 40 to 50 to 60 foot waves and you're losing people.
Right, and there's a lot of, you run into other people, but there's one other raft once in a while, but it didn't happen very often. I mean, you didn't see them too often, but when it turned over the second time, well, there was only about, I think, six or seven of us that got back on it that last time.
I imagine that can't be very encouraging either.
No, it isn't. You don't know. And one of the fellas, I remember him, that he couldn't make it either. I mean, after he got aboard, you know, he had passed away. And you have to, something like that happens, you just have to do what you can, you know. You couldn't do anything for him, and he just gagged and, you know, choked. Because you strangle. What you do, his tongue swells is what happens from the salt water. Makes you think a lot. And, of course, that's like I say, you pray a lot, too. And that's it's a good thing, you know. Glad I learned how to pray when I was young, so.
Amen to that, my friend.
Yeah.
Now, how long were you on that raft before the USS Brown finally showed up to rescue you guys?
Well, they told us that it was probably around 52 hours. It was a couple of days. Some of the ships and some of the people were out there a whole week and stuff, you know, before they were picked up. And ours, they said it was only a couple of days. And by that, I guess that time, too, I think the sharks started coming. We didn't notice the sharks so much when the waves were so high, you know, and I didn't know whether they were there or not, you know, for sure, because I was inside the raft most of the time, see, so.
If they were there, you didn't want to know about it.
No, I didn't pay any attention, no.
Yeah, you know, I referred to that cliche, holding on for dear life, but you really were, and you were holding on to a pretty extreme level. Tell our listeners what they had to do to get you off of that raft when they finally did find you.
Well, one of the guys from the ship come on down on the raft and cut the lines away from around my hands. I couldn't open my hands.
Your hands were clenched so tight around those lines of the raft that...
Yeah, they were just tight. So he come down and cut the ropes away from around my hands, and they were going to try and pull the whole raft on board, but they couldn't do it.
What did that feel like for you when you realized, I am going to make it through this? I am alive. I'm still here.
Well, I still didn't know whether I was going to. You know, I mean, I put 11 months in different hospitals after that, and they treated me like, I'd swallowed some water, too, you know, and they treated me like, in those days, they called it ulcers, you know, and it might have been ulcers, what it was. It was my stomach that was giving me a bad time quite a bit.
Yeah, your body had been through some extreme circumstances, to say the least.
I lost quite a bit of weight. Well, I don't know how much weight I lost, I mean, but when I got out of the service, they didn't want to let me out because I was I weighed less than what I went in. So
there was a pretty good reason for that.
Right.
Now, how many men had been on the Monahan?
There was 248 of us that actually, and there was only actually there were six of us got off on the thing like that, but it was only three of us that lived afterwards.
So six survived the typhoon, and only three survived long term.
Yeah.
And you are one of those three.
One time the last of the three, too.
The last one living now.
Right. The other one died last, back in Pennsylvania.
How do you account for all that? Why do you think you're the one?
Oh, boy. Well, the good Lord had something waiting for me, I guess. You figured. I don't know.
I think your wife, Colleen, probably told you that a time or two.
Yeah.
Now, tell our listeners how many children you have.
I have eight children of my own. And
how many grandchildren?
We got 22 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren and one great-great-grandchild.
And you're going to see all those people at a wedding here in the upcoming weeks?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And
they'll all be here, and it'll be a lot of picture taken and everything, yeah.
And aside from your wife, Colleen, none of them would have ever been alive if you hadn't survived on that raft for 52 hours after the Monahan sank.
Right.
That's
incredible.
I guess
I had something to do with it, I guess, didn't I?
That is absolutely incredible.
Well.
What, 11 months, you said, is how long it took you to recover. What was that time like? I imagine, in some ways, that had to be almost as tough as the time you spent out in that raft.
Well, it was a lot. I put a lot of time in, there was a Navy hospital in Corona is where I spent the most time.
Right.
It's a woman's prison now is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Navy hospital at that time, and they used it, had Quonset huts around the building. It was used to be a celebrity deal for the Hollywood stars used to come out. It was a building that was built in a C-shaped building in a... with a big swimming pool in the center.
Yep.
And the building's still there, I guess, from what I understand.
That's part of that Lake Norconian Country Club complex, right?
I don't know whether it is. I thought it was, somebody said it was a women's prison. I didn't.
Oh, yeah, I think it is now.
Yeah.
And then the Navy had some buildings there, too.
Yeah.
But that, I imagine that was pretty hard to face every day, not knowing if you'd ever be yourself again.
Well, we didn't know. We were just waiting for the war to get over, I guess. You know, I didn't know whether I'd be back to sea or not, you know. But my time was getting up anyhow, so I was ready to get out. And
what would you say that... when you look back on your time in the service, and it was certainly eventful, the years that you spent in the Navy, what would you say you're most proud of?
Oh, boy. I don't really don't know. The time I spent in the war was probably something to be proud of. But there was just so many things happen, and so you had so many friends and stuff, you know, that you met
yep.
in there, and lost a lot of them too. But the original group from the Monahan, I think there's seven or eight of us left yet of the original crew from Pearl Harbor.
Some of them have gotten off and weren't there in the typhoon.
Right. Oh yeah, some. A lot of people get transferred to new ships, you know. They had to take experienced men to help man the new ships and stuff like that, yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, Bob, I'm thankful that you survived and that you're here to tell us that story, and I appreciate your telling it to us, and I hope that all the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren understand that there's a hometown hero in Visalia by the name of Bob McNutt. Thanks so much, Bob, for your service to our country and for taking the time to share it with us. We're out of time. Join us again next week here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tell us about your hometown hero. Email your story by clicking on the Hometown Heroes link at kmj580.com.
In a recent torture test, Castrol Syntec didn't just maintain maximum horsepower longer than the leading conventional oil. It smoked it.
Lit it up like a Christmas tree. Took its lunch money, spanked it silly, took it to the House of Pain, took it down to Chinatown. Then to the woodshed, opened up a can of humiliation, and served it a cold plate of Smackdown. Get the picture? And see the beating for yourself at CastrolSyntec.com and say sayonara, ciao, see you, wouldn't want to be it to conventional oil. Castrol Syntec. It's more than just oil. It's liquid engineering.
Tested versus 5W30s.
On air, online, on demand
at KMJ580.com.
This is the big one. News Talk 580, KMJ, Fresno.
News on the hour.